Many years ago, there was a very famous study that was conducted at Stanford University. You may have heard of it before. It's known as the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment. It's very famous. What happened was a group of researchers brought in about 50 children to be part of this study. And what they did is they would bring the children in and set them at a table. And on the table was a single plate with a marshmallow on it. And the children in the study were told, now you can eat this marshmallow if you want, or if you wait 15 minutes, we will give you two. And at that, the researcher would leave the room and leave the child unattended with the marshmallow. Now, even if you've never heard of the study, you can probably guess what happened next. Some of the children immediately snatched the marshmallow up and ate it. But others, wanting the reward of two, decided they were going to try and hold on. They were going to try and fight the temptation that was in front of them, the marshmallow that was staring them in the face, and they did it by whatever means they had available to them. Two of the researchers, Mitchell and Ebsen, observed, some children covered their eyes with their hands, rested their heads on their arms, and found other similar techniques for averting their eyes from the object of reward. Many seemed to try to reduce the frustration of delay by generating their own diversions. They talked to themselves, they sang, they invented games with their hands and feet. One even tried to fall asleep and did so successfully. And that little study has been cited ever since for people's amusement, but also for its insights into the idea of delayed gratification. But if you understand anything about human nature, you know that there was going to be a struggle. That temptation is a struggle. You know, you put a child in a room with a snack, they're going to want that snack. They're going to take it and eat it. And if they're told not to, they're going to have to fight that temptation which is in them. How easily, and not just children, but all of us are turned away after some forbidden thing. The marshmallow on the table is hard to resist, but it's certainly not the only thing that's hard to resist. All of us, in many ways, are like Edmund from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, who just cannot resist the Turkish delight that's placed in front of them. Temptation is kind of like a shapeshifter. It takes a lot of different forms. It's never the same thing. There's not one size temptation. They are tailor-made. Temptation can come in the form of wealth, if you're only willing to compromise your values to get it. It could come in the form of a beautiful woman or an illicit relationship. Temptations oftentimes come wrapped in very noble dress, telling us, you know, a little lie will do a lot of good in this case. Temptations promise to make our way more pleasant, more bearable. You know, everybody's cheating. Why shouldn't you? You're going to be left behind. So whatever form it may take, temptation always comes at us, and it always steers us away from God and his commands. You know, the serpent in the garden told Eve she could have all that her heart desired if she just disobeyed the Creator. One thing that we should all, that is all of us, should expect in this life is temptation. Why? Because we all have a sinful heart. A heart that's inclined towards sin. We are drawn away from God whenever we have this carrot of desire hung in front of us. And if we don't fight it and if we don't resist that temptation, we will be drawn away. Every follower of Christ knows that it's a struggle against the desires of the flesh. We're tempted to think things that we shouldn't think. We're tempted to look at things we know we shouldn't look at. We're tempted to say something that we know is going to hurt someone else. We're tempted to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. And even when we know we're wrong, and even when we know the temptation is wrong, sometimes the draw is still there. Here's the truth. Temptation reveals what's inside of us and what we really value. Faith is tested in temptation. Question is, how will you respond? Faith is tested in temptation. How are you going to respond? And maybe that's the wrong question to ask. It's not how will you respond. The fact is, temptation is with us, I'm not going to say constantly, but regularly. So it's not really how will you respond. The question ought to be, how are you responding? How are you responding to temptation in your life? Is it a constant struggle? Is it something that you so quickly and so easily give into? How are you going to respond to temptation when it comes? Are you demonstrating your faith in how you handle it? Because temptation provides two choices. We can either indulge the sin that's presented before us, or we can resist it. The problem is resisting is hard. Giving in is so easy by comparison. Resisting takes self-control. It takes the fruit of the Spirit. It takes something divine to resist temptation. It's certainly the harder road. But if we're going to be dedicated followers of Christ, we have to learn to resist. We have to learn how to live our faith in the face of temptation. It ought to be no great surprise to us that when James is dealing with faith demonstrated, he would talk about temptation very early in his letter. This is a testing ground for what true faith looks like. How do we respond to temptation? Now, James has already talked in the first 11 verses of chapter 1 about trials. I mean, typically when we think of trials, we think of some adverse circumstance, something that happens in our life that's unpleasant, that's difficult, that is bad, and we see that as a test. Temptations, though, we see that a little bit differently. Temptations aren't just a neutral, you know, something happened, something negative in my life, but rather it is an opportunity to reach out and choose what is wrong. It's a solicitation to evil. It's an opportunity to sin. Now, here's the interesting thing. James, and I'm going to get into the Greek here, but there's a reason for it. James uses in verse 2, he says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. He uses this Greek word peresmas. Peresmas. But if you go down to verse 13, James says, let no one, when he is tempted, say, I'm being tempted by God. The word he uses for tempted is peresmas. It's the same word. So even though the idea perhaps has shifted between trials and temptations, the word has not shifted. It's the same term, which kind of confuses us a little bit because we think of a pretty hard and fast line between, okay, these are trials, these are temptations, they're very different. And yet, it appears, at least to me, that if you were a Greek-speaking person in the first century, you didn't necessarily see a hard and fast line between here's a trial, here's a temptation. And in some ways, they kind of bleed into one another. A trial can oftentimes become a temptation, right? Something negative happens and you are tempted to lash out in anger. You're tempted to respond in a way that's sinful. And so, yes, I think there is an appropriate difference. We ought to separate these two ideas of temptation and trials. But perhaps they're more intermingled than we often think. Certainly, James chooses to use the same terminology when talking about both. And both have this at the core. They are both tests of our faith. Both show if we have true faith in how we respond to them, whether it's a trial, whether it's a temptation. As we look at James, and we're going to look at verses 12 through 18 this morning, I think these are some of the most important verses in the entire Bible when it comes to the topic of temptation. How does it work? What's going on in the realm of temptation? Well, these verses really help us to understand what's happening and how to think properly about temptation. So let's unpack this a bit. And let's first look at the purpose of temptations as it's spelled out here in verse 12. The purpose of temptations. Go to verse 12. He says, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. Now, you'll notice he's talking in verse 12 about trials. And indeed, this is kind of a capstone. It's almost like a concluding statement to verses 1 through 11. Yet, what term does he use? Peresmas. So, it's the same word that he's going to use for temptation in just a moment. So, not only is this a capstone to verses 1 through 11, I think it's also a transitional statement towards what he's about to talk about. So, what he says in verse 12 applies to temptations as well as trials. Trials as well as temptations. It goes both ways. So verse 12 does help us, I think, when it comes to unpacking and thinking through what's going on with temptation and what's God's purpose in it. Again, God is not the one who brings temptation, yet God has a purpose and uses it for a purpose. Let's look at those purposes. Number one, God purposes in temptation to bring blessing. Notice the beginning of the verse. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. By the way, do you notice the echo there of Psalm 1? You know, blessed is the man who does not walk and so on and so forth. Here he goes, says, blessed is the man. you are indeed blessed, which blessed means happy, fortunate, but it refers not to so much to an emotion. It's not so much that you are, oh, I'm just brimming over with happiness, but rather sort of a settled sense of deep-seated well-being in following the Lord. So, blessed is the man who, what man is blessed? Well, he explains. He says, the man who remains steadfast under trial. In other words, who endures the trial. That's what we saw back in verse 3 and 4. But also he who endures temptation. He who remains steadfast, who doesn't give in to temptation, but remains resisting, who remains upright in temptation. He is blessed. So it's not the temptation, it's not the trial itself that's the blessing, other than the fact that it is a blessing in the sense that it allows us an opportunity to grow in endurance, in bearing up under, in resisting temptation, so that we ourselves are blessed for it. So they themselves may not be a quote-unquote blessing, but when we stand strong in them, we are blessed indeed. In other words, God's purpose for trials and temptations is that we might overcome them, that we might endure, that we might stand fast. So his purpose in temptation is that we would be blessed, not by being tempted, but blessed in resisting temptation and overcoming it. Secondly, God's purpose in temptation is to test our faith. You'll notice this also in verse 12. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast on the trial when he has stood the test. Now, some of you in this room are going to be taking tests this week. Exams, again, it's to test your knowledge, to see if you've really got the material that you've been studying all semester. Well, these events, these temptations that come along, test our faith. How are we going to respond? Are we going to just give in? Are we just going to disobey God? Or do we choose to obey and to walk in holiness? That's the test that's before us. Again, trials can oftentimes blend into temptation. You know, something unfortunate happens, something negative, as we see it, happens in our life. Suddenly we're tempted to respond negatively, to respond sinfully. It's a test of our faith, a test that God so desires that we pass. Notice he says, when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life. So he's assuming, you know, blessed is this man who resists, who doesn't give in to temptation. He has withstood the test, and he's going to be rewarded for that. He's going to be given the crown of life. Now, we don't know exactly what is involved in this reward, but it does seem like it is a reward that believers will receive in heaven for having endured temptation and endured trials that God sends. There is an actual reward of some kind that believers receive as a result of having remained steadfast. Again, we see the exact same thing in Revelation chapter 3 where John there talks about the crown of life being given to those who endure persecution. So it's to test our faith. Third, it is to prove our love, to bring blessing, to test our faith, and then to prove our love. Look at the end of verse 12. It says, God has promised this crown of life to those who love him, to those who love him. Their perseverance, or I guess I should say, let's make it personal, our perseverance in trials and our withstanding of temptations is evidence of our love for God. Do we love him? Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Obey me. If we're presented by a temptation and our first inclination is just to give in and to chase after sin, what does that say about our love for Christ? See, our love is demonstrated by passing the test, by enduring trials, by withstanding temptations. By that, we declare our love for God. So is your love for God evident in your battle with temptation? Let me ask it again. Is your love for God evident by how you fight temptation? Or is it the opposite that's evident? See, how we withstand and how we resist temptation is an evidence of our love. I read a story this week of a young man who's in high school, and was dating this girl who really was just not a very good person. And anyways, after high school, they broke up. He went off and joined the army. And he was sent all over the world with the army, and he met an absolutely wonderful young woman, and he married her. The two of them were extremely happy together. Well, after his enlistment was done, they moved back to his hometown. And one evening, he was at home, and his wife was off visiting friends or visiting her family. And this old girlfriend decided to stop by the house. And she was doing everything she could to kind of throw herself at this young man, now married. And she's flirting with him and, you know, trying to, you know, innuendos and kind of work her way in. And he just shut her down. Basically, what he did was he pulled out, again, she hadn't seen him since he'd been in the army, so he pulled out pictures and just was praising his wife to the heavens. You know, here's my wife, she's wonderful, and just keeps talking about how great she is. And finally, this old girlfriend, this old flame, you know, leaves the house, and as she does, she says, well, this new wife of yours really must be something in order to keep you from, you know, reaching out. You see, in that temptation, and I don't know exactly what was going on in that man's heart, but you know, this was obviously somebody he liked at one time. So I have to wonder if there wasn't some kind of temptation, yet his love for his wife was greater far than any kind of desire he had for this old girlfriend. So love is demonstrated in resisting temptation. I think that young wife probably would have understood that's a real example, a testament to his love. So God has a purpose in temptations. Not that God sends them, but that he has a purpose for them, that we might be tested and approved. So if God is working out his purposes in temptation, does that mean God is the author of temptation? That's the question. And James answers that question, and we look at this as the source of temptation. So we've seen the purpose of temptation, now the source of temptation. Where does it come from? Who's responsible? Maybe that's the real question. Who's responsible? Is God responsible for tempting us? If you look at ancient history, especially around Bible times, this wouldn't have been true for James' Jewish audience, but in the pagan world, the pagans had all kinds of ideas of the gods. And oftentimes the gods were extremely immoral. The gods were, you know, a lot of them pranksters. And so what they would do oftentimes is test humanity. They would tempt people to try to, you know, get them to sin or to get them to, you know, do something foolish. And so, you know, it would have been natural from somebody in James's time to think, oh yeah, if I'm being tempted, it's the gods are playing a trick on me or they're messing with me somehow. So whose fault is it? Who's responsible when it comes to temptation? I think a lot of us, our first reaction, especially when it comes to sin, is to try to blame somebody else. It's not me. It's not my fault. I have all these reasons for why I can't resist temptation. There's all kinds of reasons why, you know, I'm kind of absolving myself of any responsibility. I mean, we see this back in the very first temptation, right? The serpent comes to Eve, and then God comes to Adam and Eve after they've sinned. And Adam's first words to the Lord basically is, it's not my fault, it's this woman you gave me. And then the woman says, it's not my fault, it's this serpent that was here. And everybody's passing the blame. Well, we could do the very same thing. Look at verse 13. James says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil or with evil, but he himself tempts no one. So we really begin by thinking about where it doesn't come from. Where does temptations come from? Well, we know it doesn't come from God. He says at the beginning, let no man say. In other words, here's a prohibition. Don't anybody suggest this. It's simply not true. And what do they suggest? I'm tempted by God. That's the accusation. Well, I'm not responsible for this temptation and giving into it because, you know, God caused this to happen. And who am I to resist? You know, there's several ways that we can accuse God of trying to tempt us. First of all, we can blame God directly. That's one option. Basically say, well, God's responsible for this. You know, God brought temptation into my life, which is just clearly not true. God does test us but he does not tempt us. And this is an important difference, okay? God tests us, which means he brings circumstances into our life such that we might come through victoriously. But temptation is not that. Temptation is not a test trying to get us to come through victorious. It's a snare trying to trip us up. God doesn't set snares. So we blame God directly. You know, it's his fault. But we can also blame God for secondary causes. Like, we can blame God for our circumstances. If God had given me more money, I wouldn't be in this position. You know, if God had just made me a little bit more this way or that way, I wouldn't have such a problem with this. You know, the thief, of course, blames his poverty. You know, it's because I'm poor that I have to steal. You know, the adulterer blames God, for giving him such a, beautiful secretary or, such a unattractive wife or whatever the accusation might be. You know, the drunkard, blames God for making him this way. You know, if it wasn't for my family, then I wouldn't have struggled with this, but it's God's fault. We can blame God for our circumstances. We can also blame God for our condition. We'll say things like, this is the way I am, and I just can't change. So it's really a charge against the Creator. God, you made me this way, so you're to blame. We say things like, or we try to excuse things like laziness, anger, depression. It's just the way I am. I can't help it. I'm only human. I'm just a sarcastic person. That's who I am. I can't help but say hurtful things. Well, here's the truth. God is not responsible for your sinful responses to temptation. They come from you. So don't blame God for temptation, because God is not tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. So it's not in God's nature to tempt or to be tempted. Now, you might pause for a second and say, I have a problem with that, because doesn't the Bible say Jesus is God and Jesus was tempted? And here it says God is not tempted by evil. So what's going on? What about Jesus? Well, he faced temptation, but that was as far as it went. See, Jesus did not have what we have, which is a twisted, sinful heart that wants what God condemns. So Jesus had all the outward pressure of temptation, but he didn't have what we have, which is the sinful inclination to reach out and want it. Now, does that mean Jesus' temptation wasn't real? Well, let me ask you this. Is your temptation real even if you resist it? Because that's what Jesus did. He resisted it. You say, if I resist it, it's still a real temptation. Well, Jesus did the same thing. See, he faced all the external pressure to sin that we do without the internal inclination to sin that we have. So let me give you a little illustration I've heard before. It's a little bit like taking a magnet. A magnet has, without getting into all the properties of it, a magnet is drawn to and is attracted to, like, metal. So if you took an iron pipe and you took a magnet, they're drawn together. And to try to pull them apart, you would feel the pressure. You'd feel the force. So there's something in the pipe and there's something in the magnet that are drawn together. Now, if you take the magnet and you take a copper pipe, it's not going to stick, because there's nothing in the copper that's going to attach, right? That's going to latch on. So in a sense, you have to have both sides, and that's where temptation strikes us. Now, the magnet is not less of a magnet whenever it's touching the copper. There's just nothing in the copper to respond. And so it is, we think of this like with the situation with Christ, that we're iron. We have a quality within us which attracts, which draws together when it comes to temptation and sin. Jesus is the copper pipe. There's nothing in him that latches onto it. So if it's not from God, that's not where temptation comes from. Well, where does it come from? Well, it says in verse 14. Verse 14 says, "But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire." There's the answer. Where does temptation come from? It comes from within us. comes from our own desires. See, Jesus didn't desire evil. But for us, we have desires that cause us to reach out and respond to temptation in sinful ways. You know, Pastor James, I like to think of James as like a pastor. He identifies temptation as an appeal to the fleshly desires. There's bait, of course. We'll talk about that in a minute. But ultimately, there's a desire in our hearts. That's the source, the true source of temptation, the desires within us. So we can't blame God for temptation. We have to take responsibility for it. And I think when it comes to temptation, our most natural response for humans is to view ourselves as victims. Oh, I'm a victim. Everybody else is responsible for my failure except me. It's not my fault. I couldn't help myself. I can't help it. My desires are too strong. And anytime we say that sin isn't our fault, we lie to ourselves. You alone are responsible for giving in to temptation. So here's the really, I think, the most insightful part of all this. You know, we talked about the purpose and the source of temptation, but let's look at the path of temptation. This is verses 14 and 15. It says, but each person, when he is tempted, he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So here's the path of temptation. This is the tried and true steps that temptation takes in our lives. And I say tried and true because it's always looked like this. You know, I think Satan knows very well what people respond to. He's got lots of time to refine that. Not only that, but, you know, the old adage is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, for Satan, it ain't broke. I mean, it works on every generation just as well as it did on the last. Now, you know, some things may need to be tweaked here and there, but the path is always the same. So let's take a look at the path. Number one, it begins with what I call the starting point. The starting point, which is the bait. The bait. So the starting point is here in verse 14. He says, but each person, by the way, note that right there. In fact, if you want to underline it, you can. Each person. Notice the individuality of these temptations. It's not when, you know, temptation goes out, but each person is going to be tempted. And each person is going to be tempted and taken through these steps, which begins with the starting point. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed. So there's the bait. You know, my version says lured and enticed. Some translations will say draw out, entrap, something like that. This is the language of hunting and fishing, of sportsmanship, I guess you could call it. The first term that he uses in verse 14 is lured. And it quite literally means to draw out. And that's the job of the hunter, is to draw out the prey. Every animal that I know of will find a safe place to protect themselves, whether it's a den or a nest of some kind. You know, they have their sort of safe place, which is hidden away from the eyes of predators. Some rodents have holes in the ground they can go to avoid, you know, flying hawks or owls or something. But every creature kind of has this little place that's a safe haven, a place of protection. So the hunter's job is to draw them out, because he can't get them when they're in the den or in the nest. He's got to draw them out. He's got to make them come out for some reason. Let's take deer, for example, because it's deer season in Ohio. In fact, this past week was rifle season in Ohio. So the deer, they have their little spots hidden in the woods. You can't find them. So you've got to get the deer to come to you. And there's a couple of things that deer hunters use. I'm not a big hunter, so this is all, to me, this is all kind of theory, but maybe you've got more experience than I do with this. But there's a couple of strategies that hunters use. One is hunters will sometimes use doe urine, which sounds disgusting, but they'll use it to try and draw the bucks out. Because in heat, you know, the bucks are wandering around and they're trying to find where the does are. And so if you can make them think, hey, come over here. This is where, you know, this is where the does are. The bucks will, wherever the does, they think the does are, that's where they're going to go. And so the hunter is drawing them out. Instead of them being safely in the forest, you know, where they can hide and find protection, they're snooping around, looking over here, and the hunter is saying, come here, come here. Another strategy hunters will use is they'll take deer antlers and rattle them together. You ever seen this done? They'll rattle the antlers. And what that does is it imitates the sound of bucks fighting. Because, you know, the two bucks will crash heads together and their horns will rattle, their antlers. And so, you know, the deer is back in its place of safety and it hears the rattling of these antlers. And that tells him there's a fight. And who doesn't want to go see a good fight, you know? Like, come on, let's go. But more importantly, they think usually when two bucks are fighting, it's over a doe. And so, you know, the other deer think, oh, I'm going to move in and see what the prospects are. You know, I'm going to kind of check out what's going on here. In both cases, and there are other strategies hunters use, but in both cases, it's to draw them out. Come out. See what's over here. See what I have to offer. And then the second term, draw out, but the second one means to entice or to, quite literally, to lure. It was a fishing term. Now, James grew up around a lot of fishermen. Up in Galilee, that was one of the main professions, was fishing. So James says, the strategy of temptation is to draw out, and then it's to lure you with the bait. You think about fishing. Again, you can go into the store and look at all, like, the fishing lures. And some of them are, like, brightly colored with, like, little feathers on them and stuff like that. And I always think to myself, you know, I wonder why the fish falls for that. It doesn't even look real. But then some are very real looking, little minnows and little, you know, worms and different things. But those lures are meant to attract the fish. And we may not think they're that effective, but the fish apparently does because they see that and they're drawn towards it. You see, it's a hook meant to catch and to kill. But it's not presented that way, is it? It's presented as, here's a tasty morsel. Come and get some. Here's lunch. Dinner is served. And when the fish goes for it, he's snagged. He's caught. And see, that's where temptation starts. It starts with some kind of offer. Something is presented to us and made to look appealing. Here's something that you want. And sometimes it may not even be an outright sinful thing. It may be something like, here's security, here's love, here's respect and admiration. Don't you want that? Of course. So that's the starting point, is the bait. Secondly, though, is the selling point. The selling point. The dictionary defines the selling point as the feature of a product that makes it attractive to the customer. Here's where the bait connects with the customer. It says in verse 14, you're tempted when you're lured and enticed by his own desire. See, the bait is only effective if it matches up with the desires of that person's heart. Temptation wraps itself in sort of this glittering paper, and it makes disobedience to God look pleasant and desirable and something that you want. As I said before, the desire can be something outright sinful, like selfishness or pride or lust. But it also could be desires for very good things. You know, the desire for success or to be loved or to have a good reputation. But good desires, if they're fulfilled in a way that dishonors or disobeys God, that's sin. The point is, temptation has a selling point. It appeals to our desires. It's not just some outward thing that comes to us. It matches up with something that we long for in ourselves. Desire really motivates almost everything we do. I want you to take your finger and just flip over to James chapter 4 for just a minute. James chapter 4, listen to what he says in verse 1. What causes quarrels and fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war with you, your desires? It's the same word that's translated lust or desire in Chapter 1. You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and do not obtain. So you fight and you quarrel, and you do not have because you do not ask. And you do not ask and you do not you ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. So desire stands behind what motivates us. You know, we follow our desires because we want a certain outcome. We want a payoff. So what temptation does, it offers us that payoff. Here's what you want. Maybe we, deep down in our heart, you know, sinfully, we think to ourselves, I want somebody else to hurt as much as they've hurt me. So we lash out at them. We all of us act expecting some kind of payoff, and temptation makes the payoff of sin look good. It gives us what we want. And this is, I think, hugely important, this little phrase, by his own desire. Because if you want to combat temptation in your life, you've got to do it at the level of desire. If you think saying no to temptation is just always saying no, just say no to the wrong thing, you get worn down on that pretty quick. What we need is a change of desire so that we desire what is good, what is of God, rather than desire that is destructive. So the selling point is desire. Third is the tipping point, which is sin. So eventually, when that item is presented, here's the thing that you so like or so long for, and here's the desire that matches up with it. Well, then there's a tipping point. There's a deciding point where we choose whether or not we're going to sin. He says in verse 15, then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. So desire plus opportunity plus, you know, temptation, we could call it. When those two come together, they conceive a child called sin. And again, we don't want to push that birth illustration too far. But all of us be baited and lured. And when we go for it, when we take that bite, when we grab for that offer, we sin. Now, please remember, up to this point, there hasn't been sin. It's not a sin to be tempted. It's not even a sin to feel, you know, like, wow, that is something I kind of want. But to reach out and grab it is when we reach the tipping point. I think of this like the hook, the look, and the took, okay? So the hook is the bait. Then there's the look, where we look and desire. And then there's the took, where it takes us, and we're hooked. So lust is desire is conceived. It gives birth to sin. It has this imagery of giving birth here. And I think part of the idea that James has with this conceiving, giving birth metaphor is to say that once this process starts, it has a trajectory. This is how it goes. Unless something happens that disrupts it, sin conceives, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's allowed to grow up and it's not defeated or excised, it eventually gives birth to the ending point, which is death. The ending point. The ending point of temptation is death. Do not think for a moment that sin is innocent, that I can just sin a little sin and it will be okay. No big deal. You cannot sin without consequences. So here, the grandmother is lust, the mother is sin, the daughter is death. The Bible says the wages of sin is death. That's what you get when you sin. Now, for the unbeliever, that means eternal death. That is, if they don't turn to Christ. But how is it that the believer dies? Well, I think there is a sense in which a believer can sin without remorse in his life so much that eventually God says, that's enough. But think of it this way as well. When we choose to sin, we're choosing to practice something that is inherently self-destructive. It may not be eternal death, but there's going to be harm. There's going to be destruction in the wake when we choose to sin. So here's the pattern. The path, if you will, of temptation is there's the starting point, the selling point, the tipping point, and then the ending point, which is death. Now, here's the thing. We see this in Scripture. Let me give you two quick examples. The first one we've already referenced, Genesis chapter 3. The woman is in the garden. The serpent comes, and the serpent, you know, tells a lie. But listen to verse 6. Genesis 3:6 says, when the woman saw the tree was good for food, there's the hook. Look at this tree. It does look good. So she saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. There's the look. So the hook's there. She takes the look, and she looks, and she desires what it offers. And then it says, she took of its fruit and ate it. There's the took, the tipping point. She sinned. And what results from that? They're thrown out of the garden. Now, they didn't die immediately, but the process of death had begun. Death came by sin and death entered the world by sin. Let me give you another example that should be familiar to you. 2 Samuel 11. David is in Jerusalem, and he goes up on the rooftop, and he sees Bathsheba next door. There's the hook. There's the beautiful woman. Now, David at that point could have looked away. He could have said, oh, this wrong place, you know, sorry. Open the wrong door. But instead, he lingers and he looks. So the hook is there. He takes the look. He desires. And it doesn't stop there. He summons her. He calls her over. And that's the tipping point where he chooses to sin. And how does that story end? Death of Uriah, the death of the child. I think it gives us a good picture of what to expect from this process of temptation. But I know what you're wondering. Okay, this is all helpful to think through what this means, but what do we do? How do we fight this? How do we resist temptation? How do we overcome it? Well, I could have put a third point here, or excuse me, a fourth point, I guess, to this message. But I chose to include this in the conclusion, because really this is sort of wrapping it up. So you and I do not have to give in to temptation. Remember, temptation is a test of our faith. How are we going to respond? Well, the choice is before us. How are we going to respond? You and I don't have to give into it. And I think verses 16 through 18 give us three strategies for handling temptation. And I'll go quickly through these, but just notice them. Verse 16, James says, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers." So number one, do not fall for the deception of temptation. Sin can be made to look very good. Oh, man, that's what I want. That looks like, man, my life would be so easy to follow that path. Or maybe the problem is you're just not thinking at all. You're like the fish that's swimming around in the pond, and, you know, the fish is not sitting there thinking, I wonder if there's fishermen up there, you know, waiting to hook me. No, he's just swimming around, ooh, there's something. I'm going for it. Well, sometimes that's us. We're just not even thinking straight. Don't fall for it. Don't fall for deception of temptation. He says, don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. Don't be taken in by this. When the hook is offered and when the morsel is there, don't take it. Don't be deceived. So again, if we say that this whole process begins with the hook, with the starting point, fight it there. You know, be wary. Be on guard against temptations that would come, which would, even though they look appealing, may debase and destroy. So don't fall for the deception of temptation. Secondly, desire and rejoice in the good gifts that God gives. That's a bit of a tongue twister there at the end. Good gifts God gives. I'll say that a bunch of times. But here's the deception is, okay, here's something. This is going to make you so happy. This is what you want. And oftentimes when we fall for temptation, we sin, we find out we're more miserable than we were before. And we say, that wasn't true. That didn't bring satisfaction. Look at what James says. He says, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. You may say, well, that's a nice verse, but what does it have to do with what we've talked about? Well, look at how it connects. He says, don't be deceived. In other words, don't think that what the world is offering you is a good thing. It's not. It's a deadly thing. And he says, you want what's good? What is good comes from God. Set your desires on things above. Whatever things are noble, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely. You know, that whole list from Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. Set your mind on those things. See, if we change our desires, if our desire is, I want to glorify God, then anything that tells us, hey, you can have what you want apart from God, we say, no, that's not what I want. I want God's glory. I want his gifts in my life. Now, he says here, every good gift, that first phrase actually means every act of giving. Every act of giving and every gift, that is the object, comes down from the Father. So we can imagine a situation where somebody gives a good gift, but they don't give it in a very giving way, I guess you can say. James says, God, in his act of giving and in what he gives, is gracious and good. So what God, in other words, if we choose to say no to the world, God will make sure we have what we need. He's going to make sure we're supplied with the good things that we need. We don't have to turn to the world. We don't have to turn to sin to get what we think we need, because it'll just leave us empty anyways. So desire and rejoice with these good gifts. Now he says these come down from the Father of lights. Why does he call him the Father of lights? Well, I think because he's making reference to the heavenly bodies, the sun and the moon and the stars. He's saying, God, who doesn't change. There's no shadow of change in him. Now, the moon, for instance, is a light in the sky, and it changes throughout the month because of the shadow that's cast upon it. But God doesn't change. It's not like he's fickle and his mind is always shifting in terms of what he gives or how he gives to us. No, God is faithful. He gives what is good. So we need to desire that. Remember I said that fighting temptation happens at the level of desire? Here it is. We need to long for and love the good which God gives rather than the lies that the world supplies. The point is we need to kill sin where it starts. And then third, act in accord with your new nature. I didn't know quite how to say this, so let me kind of explain myself. Verse 18 says, of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. All right, again, you might say, well, what does this have to do with anything? Well, I think it's an example. You know, God give every good and perfect gift comes from God. And the greatest of these gifts is our salvation. He has brought us forth. Notice, by the way, the language. You know, sin brings forth death. But God in his grace brings forth life, new life, eternal life through Christ Jesus. We're brought forth by what? Not lies, but by the truth. And we become new creatures, new people, with a new nature. So what I think James is getting at is, instead of obeying the lusts of the flesh, we're a new creature, remade in Christ Jesus, to walk in the truth. Live that way. Rather than just going back to your debased old self, walk in newness of life. Act in accord with your new nature. Now, I'll close with this, because I'm probably past time when I need to end anyways. But I want to point out how these three that I've just mentioned, you know, don't fall for deception, desire and rejoice in good gifts, and then act in accord with your new nature, really is the opposite of everything we just saw in the path of sin. Sin starts by tricking us, by telling us something that's evil is good. Here, look at this delightful, wonderful thing. So to that, James says, don't be deceived. Don't be tricked by that. The next thing that sin tries to do is it tries to find some desire in us and try to say, here, I can meet that desire. I can fulfill that want, that need in your life. And James says, everything you need is from the Lord. You don't need that. And then the tipping point, when we choose to sin, that's when James says, listen, you're a new creature. You're a new creature in Christ Jesus. You've been brought forth by the word of truth. Just as sin brings forth death, so God brings forth a new being, a new person who's not enslaved to sin but can live in victory over it. This is one of the greatest needs we have, is to demonstrate our faith in resisting and responding well to temptation. Sometimes I don't know how to pray for everybody in this room. Usually my prayer is, Lord, help them stand strong in temptation. That's such a good prayer because it's a reality you're going to face. So maybe whenever you're thinking to pray for our students while they're back home for Christmas break, or maybe students whenever you're thinking of your church family here in Ohio, in Springfield, maybe the prayer you can ask for one another is, Lord, keep them strong in temptation. Keep them true to your word. That's what we need.